I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The next chapter.
I think words are a double-edged sword.
He really thinks that ESL is just a scam.
I love setting. It's, I think, my favorite thing to write.
The next chapter.
CBC Radio 1.
And Sirius XM.
If you really love a book, it's hard not to gush about it. But overselling a book has its dangers. And my experience saying to somebody, you'll love this book, pretty well guarantees it won't live up to the billing. So now I leave it to the professionals. And that would be our stable of next chapter columnists. You can hear what they have to say and then make your own decision. And if one of their recommendations takes you outside your reading comfort zone, all the better. Today, our columnist Tressa Levasseur joins me to recommend audiobooks. And if you've never tried to listen to a book, this could be the time. She'll close the program. In a half an hour, the novelist Shun King will talk with our contributor Ryan B. Patrick about millennial life in Hong Kong and why he chooses to write about that. But first, book talk contributor, podcaster, Oxford University student, and now debut author Sara Mukul Rana. She'll be here in a few minutes to tell us about what sparked her writing career and her debut novel, Hope Ablaze. I'm Ali Hassan. Welcome to the next chapter. Sara Mukul Rana has a lot going on in her life right now. She's a master's student at Oxford University. She's also the co-host of the podcast On the Right Track. That's right, as in W-R-I-T-E, the more relevant one for our show. And she's a personality on Book Talk with 26,000 followers. And on top of all that, Sara's just written her first book. Her new novel is called Hope Ablaze. It's about Nida Siddiqui, who's also got a lot going on in her 18-year-old life. She's a Muslim Pakistani-American in the last year of high school. She has plans to go to university, and she has plans to also carry on her uncle's legacy. He's a renowned poet who is in prison for terrorism crimes he didn't commit. But all of Nida's plans and her life in general get turned upside down after she's roughly and unlawfully frisked at a political rally for a Senate candidate. From there, Hope Ablaze explores politics, poetry, and a young woman's coming of age. Sara Mukul Rana joins me from Oxford today to talk about her new book. Hi, Sara.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Thank you for having me on.
Oh, our pleasure. Congrats on this debut novel.
Thank you.
You were 18, from what I understand, when you started writing this first draft of Hope Ablaze. What got you started writing this story that's aimed at both adults and young adults?
So actually, I was a bit younger when the idea was conceived. I think a lot of young Muslims, or even anyone from any ethnicity that is not white, definitely feels levels of frustration living in the West, especially if you're one of the only people of color at school, especially if you're singled out for your identity. And if you are an artist in any form, like a poet or a writer, sometimes you use art as a means to cope with those complicated feelings of identity or feeling lost. And that's kind of what I ended up doing. And so the idea was conceived much earlier, but I was able to begin writing the draft when I was 18 and 19, and primarily during the COVID pandemic, when I was kind of stuck in Pakistan when the travel ban happened during COVID. And I just was very inspired to finish the draft when I was surrounded by family and love, but also, you know, post-Trump era.
Well, let's dive right into the book and get into some of that. Tell us what happens after Nida is unlawfully frisked and what happens if it throws her life into such disarray?
So Nida is a poet, and she writes letters just to herself to cope with feelings of confusion, being lost, and also incidents of racism or things she just cannot understand. She is a hijabi, and that hijab is important to her because it was something that is a symbol of her religion and religiosity. And so one day when she's walking back to go home, she's actually frisked at a rally that's happening for a Democratic candidate. And after that happened, she goes home and she writes a letter just to cope, being obviously traumatized because she didn't understand why she was singled out. And in her notebook, she has a journal full of letters just like this. And so one night, actually at that night, her poetry notebook mysteriously disappears. But a few months later, she finds out that she was entered in a poetry contest, a very reputable one, and that her letter, because she won that contest, it goes viral. And then her entire life gets upended because people start interpreting her poetry in very unjust ways.
Mm. You capture the complexity and love of Nida's family in your novel. And at the heart of all of that is this push and pull of Nida's relationship with her mother, who she calls Amma, and then her uncle, who she calls Mamu. How would you describe the relationship between Nida and Amma?
So Nida is also someone who aspires to be like either her mother or her uncle. And I think any teenager can attest to that, especially if you have maternal or paternal figures that you look up to. So on one hand, you have her mother, who is hardworking, a single mom. She's running her own food business, which was actually inspired by my parents, who have a Pakistani restaurant in Canada. But she runs a food business, hustling, you know, winning hearts of people in the community and beyond with her food. And she raises three kids by herself. So Nida admires her in that respect. On the other hand, you have her uncle, her Mamu, who is a very famous poet within Karachi, as well as within their local community in America. And he was a pretty well-known activist who would go viral online through his poetry mobs, his symposiums, his spoken word slams. And he founded the Poets Block with other poets, which is this niche little community of Muslim poets who perform and spread awareness through their art. And so she admires her uncle in that respect as well, because he's not afraid to speak his mind and use his art. And that's something that Nida struggles with, because she is very insecure about her art. She does not want to share it. But she's torn between these two opposite ends of the spectrum, where you have her mother, who believes in conforming to society and while still being Muslim, but being more negotiable with that identity and not exactly doing things that would bring attention to you. Being safe with your career choices, being safe with the way that you perform that identity outside the home. Mm. On the other hand, you have her uncle, who believes in the opposite, not conforming, believes in being unapologetically Muslim, and also using your art to speak for what's right, including human rights.
I should mention that moment where Nida is frisked, it occurs while she's praying, she's trying to pray. She's in a park where a political rally is about to begin, and the police target her as a possible security threat. They yank the hijab from her head. That moment felt intensely personal. How personal was that?
It was very personal. I think almost every hijabi, actually every hijabi I have spoken to, in some way has been frisked, both physically or just singled out and profiled. One thing that I struggle with, because I've traveled to so many different countries working, and I wear my hijab when I do so, is the fact that I pray 5 times a day, and I refuse to compromise on it because, you know, prayer is a personal and important matter, and it doesn't harm anyone. If I had to pray and I was running out of time because I was running and hustling, I would try to find like a corner in the park or a corner in a library. As long as I was not in the way of people, I would never be in the way of people. But that's how Nida felt. She had to go to a park. It's a public space. People are occupying that park in different ways, like sitting on it, you know, playing ball, listening to music, running around. So that is your right. And so in that park, she decides to pray, and she is unjustly singled out. And I've obviously been in similar, not as brutal, I would say, but similar circumstances where, you know, I'm praying and I've been approached, or I'm just standing, or I'm standing in line. Even when I'm in the airport, post-security, I'm still singled out and pulled aside and asked really absurd questions about why do I have a bag in my hand? Oh, that bag has shoes in it. Why do you have shoes in that bag? It's very absurd. So I wanted to really personify that within that scene and just show people how incredibly ridiculous it is.
This book takes us into a very vibrant, culturally rich community, the Al-Rashid neighborhood. It takes us into people's homes, into the mosque, into the poet's block that you mentioned, where Nida shares her poetry with her friends. We get to see your characters live their lives. We get to see them, you know, hear them speak their own language. The power of words, whether written or spoken, is an important theme in this book. What are your thoughts about the power of words to do good in the 21st century, this time filled with slander and fake news and polarization?
I think words are a double-edged sword. Either words, as you mentioned, are used to manipulate the masses, are used to incite hate and divide people. But on the other hand, words, especially art, are so important in bridging communities. For example, I've had many readers reach out to me who are from different backgrounds, not just Muslim or Pakistani or South Asian, and they really connected with the novel. And so my point here is that words are powerful because they can also heal. Mm. And so while we have very hate-mongering characters and people out there, it's art and words, primarily in that art, that will bridge people and bring us together, because you can learn about different cultures that you otherwise wouldn't, or you can have comparisons and commonalities with people that you also otherwise wouldn't through art. And in Oxford, when I go to Poetry Society, I meet people who sit down with me at a table and discuss poetry, and we find commonalities. And I would never have a coffee with these people otherwise, but it was through art that I was able to do that.
Hmm. You know, I mentioned to you just before we got started that this one of the most interesting things about this book was this use of poetry and prose. My grandfather, maternal grandfather, was the father of modern prose poetry in Pakistan. His name was N.M. Rashid, Noon Mim Rashid. And poetry was a big part of our life growing up. And, you know, my dad revered this guy, Faiz Ahmed Faiz, one of the greatest poets from Pakistan, also imprisoned like Mamu in this book. So it's a lot of memories of interesting things that I've grown up with that I really enjoyed, and I'm hopeful that people will enjoy that as well. You also use these elements of speculative fiction, which I don't think I should give too much away, but can you describe the relationship that Nida develops with her pen?
The pen was the first creation that we say by God. And so the pen is a sacred, I guess, motif throughout, I think, different Abrahamic religions, honestly, because the pen also writes your deeds, your good and bad deeds. It writes your fate in the Book of Fate, we call it. But also the pen in the human world, in the material world, is also, you know, a way that you connect with people, that you transcribe and translate ideas. And so it's very powerful because this is how you build a human connection. But on the other hand, if you abuse that power and if you are dishonest with the pen, that's what leads to society's corruption, and that's how you lead to people who spread hate. And so Nida, in using her pen, and I also don't want to give too much away, is she ends up learning about the responsibility writing poetry and how not to abuse it, because she becomes tempted throughout the novel to lie with the pen. And so she feels the repercussions through the speculative fiction or speculative magic, where she's essentially cursed. And so she has to figure out how to break this curse at a personal level, but also how to reclaim the pen back and learn the sacred responsibility with it. So I really wanted to put some religious imagery, but also show people that there's a lot of lying and dishonesty with the pen. And even me as an author, I have a responsibility to be as truthful as I could. And I hope that came across.
I'll have to say that also, I'd be remiss not to mention that the smells and tastes of food are everywhere in this novel, especially in Nida's home. It's probably why my stomach is grumbling as I'm speaking to you right now. Her mother is a caterer, loves to feed her own family as well. You mentioned that your family also has a restaurant. Is your mother as good a cook as Nida's?
Yes. So my mother's name is Nahid Mughal. She is the best cook. And I say this completely unbiased. Hmm. Best cook ever. Even in Wisconsin, when I was growing up, people would drive from Chicago, which is like hours, like 2-3 hours away, to come on Eid just to taste my mom's food. Or when my mom would throw a davat, which is a gathering, a community gathering, people would drive out of state just to taste my mom's food. And my mom is unique because she can cook different ethnic foods. So she cooks Sindhi food primarily, but she can cook Punjabi, Karai, and Punjabi food. And so my mother's work always meant the world to me, and I wanted to really put that in the novel. So I hope people did get hungry, because I did writing it.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to ask you was about Nida's own fear or reluctance about entering poetry contests, right? Her friends want her to share her poetry, but she doesn't want to make it public. And it made me wonder about you publishing this book, which is full of beautiful, honest, raw poetry and, you know, genuine thoughts about what it's like to be in a multi-generational Muslim family. How much did you share that fear that Nida has in this book?
I fear it every day. I'm very anxious, and I'm glad I'm in school because it distracts me while this book is coming out and having to market the book. But yes, I share that fear deeply and immensely. I don't go to slam poetry sessions. I don't do any of that. I do not perform my poetry because I'm too scared, just like Nida. So I think in some ways, even though she is a very different character from me, some of that fear in her arc is probably a manifestation of what I hope to do one day, that she was able to perform it in front of people that weren't just Muslim and share it. So I do share that. And I also think no artist or writer needs to be public to be legitimized as an artist. You don't need to be a award-winning or a contest-winning or a public performer to be a poet or a writer. I did most of my writing when I was young, just privately. And even now, I have a lot of a tough time sharing it. So I don't think anyone needs to be a public writer. And Nida also learns that she does not need to do any of this publicly. As long as she makes that choice out of a act of agency, that's what matters. But if she doesn't want to do it, she shouldn't. And I hope that came across to readers.
Mm-hmm. How do your parents feel about your writing and about this debut novel?
So I never told my parents, even when I got the publishing deal. I kept that to myself. I told my sister because I was too shy. I didn't think they would understand. They're not against it. I didn't think they would be against it. In fact, I think they would be proud, and they are. But I just didn't want to share it because I didn't know how to explain it. So I kept my publishing deals quite private. And then when the physical book came in the mail, then I had to tell them, and they're very happy and proud of me. But obviously there is a language barrier, so that makes me sometimes feel kind of okay with it because they don't have to read my writing, so I don't feel that self-conscious
anymore. That's fine. I think you did the right thing. I know when I was going to have a son, and I was suggesting some of the names to my dad. My dad had like a critique of every one of those names. He's like, oh, that's a pedestrian name. There's nothing good about that. Oh, that name, I knew a guy like that in high school with that name, and he sucked. And I'm like, oh, my God. The best thing is just name the kid, present the kid, and everyone goes, beautiful kid. And I think your book is probably received like that. It's a beautiful baby that's going to be welcomed into the family.
Well, I do want to say that the most stressful part of being an author is trying to name your characters, because then people in real life who have that name, especially in the brown and Muslim community, will be like, oh, is that character based off me? And if they're the villain, you're like, damn, because I have friends who are named after the villain in the book. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. It was a coincidence.
Very nice to speak to you, Sarah. Congratulations. Thanks for taking the time out. I hope we didn't take away too much time from your schoolwork.
No, it was a huge honor to be on here. Thank you so much for these thought-provoking questions. It was very fun.
All right, thank you. Sarah Mokhul-Rana is the author of Hope Ablaze. She was in Oxford. Thank you. 27 Minutes is the debut novel from Ashley Tate, and it is what the publishing world calls an instant national bestseller. It's a character-driven mystery about a small town dealing with the aftermath of a tragedy. Grief, secrets, and regret continue to swirl around a fatal car accident that happened 10 years earlier. Here is Ashley Tate.
The small town really does have such an impact on these characters, and there are definite pros and cons to living in one. And a con, I would say, or perhaps just a con in this situation, is that you can't really escape your past. Everyone knows your business. Everyone knows you, your parents, your cousins, your siblings. And generationally, these events just linger and you just cannot break these bonds. I love setting. It's, I think, my favorite thing to write. And I don't know if people will be surprised that I didn't grow up in a small town. I did grow up in Toronto. But my mother, who was so much a part of the story, grew up in a tiny rural community in PEI. So I spent a lot of time there when I was a child on this farm that she grew up in, that my grandfather built. It was a town of 250 people, just really remote, really small. And it had such an impact on me as a child. I loved it. And I think maybe because of the age, I was, you know, a kid, and these were just such wonderful memories that I love writing about small towns. The inspiration behind the novel itself was after my mother passed away, I really needed a creative outlet. So it was very much a catharsis for me through the grieving process of losing my mom. I hope people take away from this book how grief can last, that it is not something to get over, that it is something that you have to learn to live with, and that we need to talk about it more.
That was Ashley Tate talking about her debut novel, 27 Minutes.
Hello, I'm Madison, singer, songwriter, musician from Cranbrook, British Columbia. I describe my music as mountain rock and roll, country soul. Right now, I am reading Women Who Run With the Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes. The book is like a powerful exploration of the wild feminine spirit. It's filled with stories and myths that guide women on a transformative journey to reclaim their wisdom and strength. For me, this book has helped me navigate situations where I may have quieted my own intuition and knowing, especially being a solo female artist in the music industry. So there was one particular story that was about how sometimes when we let our spirit go, we become like sick, like mentally, physically ill when we aren't channeling our soul and our things that excite us. And that happens in many different ways in relationships and when you're not doing work and things that excite you and fill your passion. So that was something that really stuck with me. I would recommend this book to anyone. Actually, I recently recommended this book the other day to my dad, because I was like, this is so impactful and it's been a tool and a great read for me to rechannel that inner knowing.
That was BC singer and songwriter Madison. We'll be back after these messages.
I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of 6 darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Aaron Tang writes under the pen name Shun King. His 2020 breakout hit, You Are Eating an Orange, You Are Naked, was a finalist for the 2021 Governor General's Literary Award, Amazon Canada First Novel Award, and longlisted for Canada Reads that year. He was praised for his innovative and unique style, and he brings the same flair to his new novel. And just a warning here, the new book title contains some foul language. It's called Batshit 7, and it's the story of Glenn Wu, a millennial living through the Hong Kong protests, teaching ESL, and trying to figure out where he fits. Our contributor Ryan B. Patrick spoke with Shun King, and here is that interview.
So your book is about a person named Glenn Wu. He's also known as Glue, and it's about his feelings of disconnection as a millennial living in Hong Kong. Who is Glue at the start of the book?
Glue's an international student, and he just returned from Toronto to Hong Kong, and he studied drama. He went to teacher's college. He dropped out from his MFA program in creative writing. And can't find a job, so he's doing freelance translation gigs, but it's not very stable. And he's contemplating becoming an ESL instructor, but he kind of has this disagreement with like how ESL is taught, and ESL is an institution, so he's struggling a lot when he comes back to Hong Kong.
Mm. And the book mindfully and carefully explores life in Hong Kong. It kind of looks at the legacy of the British occupation, and it's set around the time of a lot of social unrest, particularly around 2019 or 2020 in Hong Kong. Why did you want to write about and around this time?
It's right before COVID, and as a millennial who's returning to Hong Kong at that time, having been overseas all this time, one might be disoriented, thrown into this situation when there's so much change happening. There's so much news coming out every day. But as a Hong Kongese person living abroad, you have this kind of detachment towards the place, but you still kind of want to connect. And parts of your identity are always like needing to shift because you're not really a local person anymore, having been an international student, but you're also not belonging to another place. So a lot of the things that are happening around that time really kind of pushes Glue into thinking about how does he find a place here? How does his identity kind of fit in this place and all this chaos?
So can we talk about the title, like, without talking or saying the title? Like, what's the meaning behind the book title?
Yeah, the book title with the number 7, it's referencing July, the day, 1st of July is when the British handed over Hong Kong. And then Hong Kong from that point on entered something called the 50-year plan, where it has its own sovereignty, but it's also part of Greater China. So I'm referencing that number a lot throughout. The Cantonese of 7 can also mean other things. Mm. And this idea of living in a place where there's a deadline, it expires, there's only 50 years for it to be what it is. So this kind of search for identity parallels that of Glue's as he returns to Hong Kong as well. So the number 7, because of this, I picked as part of the title because all of these kind of parallels.
Mm. Mm. And you do have a knack for inventive titles. Like your last book was titled You Are Eating an Orange, You Are Naked. And that book, of course, was nominated for the Governor General's Award for Fiction. And it also explored that transnational experience. Why is that experience such a rich place for writing fiction in your mind?
Because I haven't read too many books about first of all, about international students, and I haven't read too many Canadian books about international students, and those are people who are in my community. Those are my friends when I was living in Canada when I was growing up, and being an international student seems to be something that's very kind of odd because now I'm working at an international institution, but in Hong Kong instead. And when you're like preparing yourself as an international school student, you're preparing yourself to not be in the place where you're studying. You're preparing yourself to go elsewhere. And then once you go elsewhere, you're preparing yourself to kind of come back or preparing yourself to stay. And this kind of mobility is quite interesting to me, because most of my friends growing up are also like that. And I noticed that there are many similarities, but life is also very precarious.
Mm. And talk about bringing it back to Glue, like he becomes an ESL or English as a Second Language instructor, which has some of the most funny parts of the book. What does Glue think about his job?
Glue at first really despises his job. He really hates himself for doing that. He really thinks that ESL is just a scam, making people take the IELTS test for like $100, $200 a test to get like a number is not really good education. But at the same time, he, being in the state that he's in, being so unstable and feeling like, oh, my family actually like is trying to support me, but I'm not doing anything to advance my own career or situation, then he kind of is forced into this situation, and it brings out a kind of masochistic side of Glue. In order to cope with his being an ESL teacher, he self-orientalizes. Mm. He starts speaking Chinglish to people. And he starts speaking Chinglish to his sister. He puts on an accent. He overperforms.
Yeah. And being a millennial and he's living through the Hong Kong protests, he has almost a nihilistic approach to seeing the world. Why does he lean so heavily on like things like marijuana or sex to cope? Why are those his coping mechanisms?
I think he just feels very, very lost. And he also has these relationships with other relationships with people in his life that he kind of doesn't really know how to navigate. Mm-hmm. He has this relationship with someone who might or might not have stolen something from him. He's longing for somebody who he once met in Toronto. He feels very isolated. He hangs out with his like one childhood best friend who actually allows him to lean into drinking more and doing more drugs. In a way, it kind of feels like how it's like for a lot of people here during that time. It's a sense of hopelessness and missed like so much change that you just kind of lose yourself, and your day-to-day survival just consists of coping mechanisms that are kind of available to you.
Mm. And I like, even though he's kind of moping through life and he's despondent and whatnot, he's no slouch in the intellectual department. Like, he has these very insightful thoughts about the post-colonial condition, thinking about philosophy, thinking about colonization, decolonization. Can you elaborate more about that? What's his take on the whole situation here?
Glue feels like there's a sense of amnesia, a connective amnesia that he feels in Hong Kong, because it's so focused on finance and everyday life is very kind of corporate, and he doesn't have access to any kind of like art scene or communities. He lives in the suburbs, alone in an island in his childhood home. And all of this is the doing of all of the larger governments that were in charge of Hong Kong. And Glue is aware that Hong Kong is designed to be a place like this. And he was, why he longs for Canada is not only because of somebody he misses, but also back then he was more intellectually engaged. He was an activist. He had a better connection with his sister, and they would go to protest together. And he actually remembers like a lot of his training in Marxism and decolonial theory, but it's slowly going away when he becomes more and more consumed by the kind of market forces that are used to create these empires.
Right. There's so much to unpack in this book. But before I get into like his mind state or his anger, can we talk about the QR codes that are featured in the book? They kind of encourage readers to scan them with their phones for like added or bonus content. Tell me more about them and why do you include them?
The QR codes, I thought it would be a good touch because a lot of the time when Glue is in the washroom, he watches videos and he scrolls. Mm-hmm. And then some of the content actually kind of influence some of the decisions that he makes. And I thought it'll be a nice touch if the readers could also interact with the text and scan them and see the kind of content that like goes through Glue's mind that leads him to these decisions. So I think having that is it creates a closer connection to Glue, but also the act of scanning a book and entering like the parallel text that the book kind of navigates the reader towards to look at like what Glue looks at through that lens. I think that's another way to engage with the text in a almost kind of like rhymesomatic way, because you're bouncing back and forth between the what's in the QR code and what's in the book. And it's just a very interesting way to read to me.
Right. So I don't want to give too much away, but around, like I said, it's set around the Hong Kong protests and Glue's mind state is unraveling. Without giving too much away, why should we empathize with what he's going through towards the end of the book?
I think in the end, Glue kind of succumbs to all the pressure. He breaks, and a lot of his ideals are falling apart. And he becomes in a way like lost again. But he finds himself in this place, and I think a lot of people who are going through so much change in this part of Asia might also feel is that there's nothing much else that you could do but do whatever you need to survive in this place that's designed to let you to survive. I was hanging with some friends who were visiting from Canada. Who I've met there, and they feel like they have the pressure to like enjoy all the progress and find the economic growth that like happened. They actually feel like they need to live a more kind of materialist consumerist lifestyle because the state presents itself as having done so much so that we can live like this. And I think that really affected Glue towards the end of the book, where he is exhausted and hollowed out and succumbs to being one of the returnees, people who return from foreign countries to work. Mm.
But ultimately, this book is an ode of sorts to Hong Kong and the transnational experience. What are some of the joys of living in Hong Kong for these characters?
Oh, yes. Thank you for such a wonderful observation and question. For these characters, I think they do love Hong Kong. They love the food. Food is a big part of the culture and the scenes with the family, the bonds that they make over food. I think Glue does enjoy his neighborhood in the suburbs next to the airport. There's something really romantic about this place that's right next to the airport. It's old and new at the same time. It has a distance from the financial districts, but it's also a lot more diverse than other suburbs in Hong Kong. And I think Glue does like the local life there. He likes the moments when he gets to play pickup basketball. He likes that he gets to run around in the humidity and sweat. And to a certain degree, he also loves running in the rain. Running in the rain and laughing to himself and all of these these kind of affects is coming from, like, a genuine love for the place, the little things that, like, might not matter to a lot of the other people.
Aaron, thanks so much for the conversation.
Oh, thank you so much, Ryan.
Aaron Tang, also known as Shung King, is the author of Bat Shit 7. He joined me from Hong Kong.
I've noticed lately that more and more people are adding audiobooks to their reading routines. I mean, that's admittedly from a random sample of friends and family, but the numbers support that. It's been a booming segment of the publishing business for a few years. And last summer, the New York Times Book Review added an audiobook of the week column to their roster. Our columnist, Tressa Levasseur, is a trusted reader and an equally good listener. She's been on the audiobook beat for us, and she joins me now in the Toronto studio. Hi, Tressa, and welcome back.
Good day. It's great to be here.
So are you finding yourself one of those people in my random sample who are listening to more and more audiobooks?
I still lean, honestly, towards the printed page or the pixelated page, as it were, because I've made the migration to the e-reader. Uh-huh. But yeah, you know, audiobooks are really great for reading while you're doing other things, such as cooking, driving, etc., walking. And so to up my book count in my endless competition with my sister-in-law to read the most books in a year, I was like, how did you read 160 books last year, Sonia? She was like, well, I listen to a lot of books. And there is some controversy out there about whether listening to an audiobook is the same as reading a book. Is it indeed reading? It's a very contentious topic. I would say that it is. I would say that if you're going to commit 11 hours to a book, you've read it.
It isn't for me because I will drift off way too often. The page captures my attention, but something about my undiagnosed ADHD is really activated by an audiobook. Hey, that guy just said banana. Remember those bananas we had that time? Oh, that was weird. And now I'm like, oh, I haven't listened to the last 15 minutes of this audiobook.
I would say that it is possible that playing with the speed setting could enable you to enjoy an audiobook more with some neurodiversity. My neurodiverse friends tend to listen a little faster. Mm-hmm. Also, it is the narrator that makes the book. And there are many poorly narrated books out there, and there are some true jewels, one of which I will discuss today.
You've just proven why you are our audiobook expert right there, giving all these options to people. So what is the first audiobook on your list?
I think I want to talk about my very top audiobook listen fiction of all time. It's a book called Tom Lake by Ann Patchett. And Ann Patchett is a beloved writer. I've read many of her books in print. But this one is narrated by none other than Meryl Streep. And I'm here to tell you that Meryl Streep, she sets the bar for audiobook narration in a manner that I can hardly describe. Mm. She brings it all to life. She manages to inhabit each character in this book so that they are very separate in the mind of the listener without resorting to accents or caricature.
I cannot conceive of a world where my attention would be diverted if Meryl Streep was reading to me.
Great. And also, in terms of the audiobook content, think about it like you might consider thinking about it if you have a self-described attention span that is shorter, as like eat a chapter. Mm. Eat a little chapter and then put your music back on. Do a few reps at a light weight. Build up. But this is quality reading and quality writing. One of the reasons this book as a book, narrator aside, works as an audiobook in my mind is that it's a story within a book.
So in this book, we are in pandemic times. A woman of middle age, her three daughters, young adult daughters, have come home to work on the cherry farm for the summer during pandemic times. And they are requesting that she tell the story of when she was their age and she was in a summer stock theater production of Our Town with someone who became a very famous actor. And so Meryl Streep is going back and forth between narrating the current time, which is pandemic times, and her delight in her daughters, and also the experience of these young women in pandemic and their experience of climate grief versus her experience of climate grief, their experience of family versus her experience of family. But then there's this flashback component where she goes back in time and she's talking about her time in her 20s, this youthful time of her being in this summer theater production and falling in love for the first time. And there is something about that, too, that pulls you in, where you're never in one thread too long. You're never really bored because she's reminiscing and then flipping you back to the present and contextualizing it.
That's very interesting. And that works well in an audiobook format to have.
I really found that it did. And it's narrated in the first person, which is my preference for an audiobook. Third person narration can be confusing. But this is 5 stars. Really.
Okay, awesome. What is the, we can only go down from here? Is that the way I look at this?
Yes.
Oh, no. What is the second book on your list?
Okay, we're not going down here. We're going sideways. Gutter Child by J.L. Richardson, which won a first novel award, narrated by Phoenix Pagliacci, is a young adult book set in a dystopian universe in which people are separated by race from the mainland, and then there's the gutter, and the Sosie people are indentured servitude set up. And the narrator of this book, it's again a first-person book, is a young woman named Elamina. And what I loved about this book, okay, I love YA fiction. I love dystopian fiction. I love that I could imagine this pretend world being very, very real. There were hints and threads of Handmaid's Tale in this book that I felt all the dystopian fiction of all the time, the Octavia Butler. This author, J.L. Richardson, she's obviously extremely well-read, and she is pulling from a long tradition to build this world. And she doesn't overly describe things for me. She lets me imagine the world for myself. Mm. I loved the ending. I was expecting a different, more pat and concluded ending. And I was left like, what? Like you kind of feel at the end of a Bergman film, like a bit like, huh? And I loved this narrator, Phoenix Pagliacci, hip hop artist, activist, Canadian. I loved the narration. I thought this person inhabited the character extremely well. And just trusted the words.
So before you go, I know you have a couple of short snappers that you want to mention, books that you read in both formats, you listened to and you read. What are these final books and how do they rate?
So the third book is a book called The Whispers by Ashley Audrain. It's a hyper contemporary suspense thriller family drama. I am going to describe it as 50 Shades of Grey's Anatomy on a train. So it's a mashup of a lot of books. If you liked 50 Shades of Grey, if you liked Girl on a Train, if you like the show Grey's Anatomy, you'll probably really like this book. It's a propulsive narrative. And I wanted to compare it briefly to a book by Claudia Day called Daughter, which I read in print, but in audiobook format. So good.
Okay.
It's narrated by a huge cast. So it's in third person. And it's interesting to notice where the director of this audiobook has chosen to like put the various actors. I found that very interesting. And it's like Kristen Thompson, Ellie Moon, Haley Gillis, Tom McCamus. Like the cast is incredible. And the sparse, elegant, like sort of thin nature of the prose. Like, it's very direct, lends itself to the audiobook format. So I preferred this one, this notable book of the year, most anticipated read. I really did prefer it in an audiobook format, which, you know, that's a new experience for me.
All right. Very illuminating and, on a personal note, inspiring. I might give some audiobooks a try. I'll look for people who have attention issues like I do and look at their recommendations. Or I'll just reach out to you directly, Tressa.
Well, and you know what? Next time I come visit, I'll be curious to know. You can show me your muscles, your audiobook reading muscles. I'll be curious to know how that went for you.
It would be also great if I just had incredible muscles, but I had done no audiobook reading. Either way, I win, is what I'm saying. Thank you so much for coming in. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Tressa Levasseur is a singer, musician, and arts administrator, and the audiobooks she talked about today are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter. And that is it for our show this week. Jacqueline Kirk is our senior producer with Lisa Matthews. And my thanks this week to Laura Antonelli, Emily Chiarvesio, Olivia Pasquarelli, and to the CBC Books digital team. Coming up next week, our columnist and colleague Bridget Raimundo will be here to tell us about the new genre of romanticy. And I'll be speaking with philosopher/novelist Scott Alexander Howard about his new book of speculative fiction, The Other Valley. I'm Ali Hassan. Thanks for listening to The Next Chapter.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.